In this episode of the Smart Community Podcast, I had a brilliant chat with Dr. Catherine Laughlin, an award-winning, internationally recognized trailblazer in place science, earning her the name of the City Doctor. Catherine tells us about her background in social work and why that's so powerful in placemaking. Catherine and I discuss the idea of smart community as a deliberate community and why it's so important to be aware when there may be a tale of two cities happening, where one part of the community is thriving while the other is just surviving. We explore how fundamental place is to human existence and well-being and the interconnection between place and work. Catherine then tells us about some of the work she does as the place doctor, including cities charting attachment to place with corporations to help them attract and retain talent, and with Amazing Place Productions, which tells the stories of places. Catherine explains how work-life balance has become more of a focus for citizens and why we need an alternative to the needs-based or social argument when it comes to getting governments and organizations on board with smart community concepts. We finish our conversation discussing the need for values-based and common ground-based conversations around difficult and divisive community issues. As always, I hope you enjoy listening to this episode as much as I enjoyed making it.
Welcome to the Smart Community. Smart regions, smart towns, and smart cities. It's where we live, work, and play with smart communities. The future starts today. Big data, smart mobility, emerging trends galore. The Smart Community Podcast is what you're looking for.
Hello, Catherine. How are you?
I am good. How are you?
I am super. Let's jump straight in. And can you tell us about your background and what you're passionate about?
Sure. So I actually come to this with a background in social work, which is a little bit unusual for the field in the sense that when you're talking about building places and how you do that effectively, sometimes social workers are not the first people you would think would be at the table, but you should, because we really come at this with an orientation of understanding person and environment fit and how that affects the environment as well as the person. So I have always had a history of being passionate about taking sort of that discipline to new areas and new fields and doing innovative work within the field of social work. And it's something I've always been passionate about and figuring out how we can disseminate that kind of orientation to systems, but also how we can bring this message to the mainstream so the people who we're talking about can be active parts of the conversation as well.
Excellent. And what sparked your interest in this smart community space?
Well, I was trained, of course, in social work with an orientation both towards families and children, as well as community practice. And I started really in my graduate school looking at, you know, what are the things about a community that seems to make them a little more resilient than perhaps another community? How are things shaped? How are opinions shaped? And so I focused a lot at that time on the power of the local press in really affecting social issue perceptions, and as well as how we can work more effectively with the press to be able to sort of use their power, if you will, for good and not necessarily evil. And so from that, I was recruited from graduate school for the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, which is a very large foundation here in the States that focuses on 26 cities. And I worked there as a program director for a while, really still doing that community-based approach. And then when I left the foundation, I stayed on as a consultant. And the first really big project I got was Soul of the Community, which was the studying of 26 U.S. communities over 3 years to really try to understand what makes people love where they live and why it matters to local economies and to people. And that really was the last, I always say that's the last thing I remember, because after that, I was really launched into this space of how you build effective community based on empirical data and understanding what makes a great place and why it really matters to people and economies, and really putting some serious data behind a conversation that was growing in the US and really around the world, which is the power of place in today's world.
Excellent. So what is a smart community to you?
I really think that a smart community is, and I think of this as I always do about these concepts, in very humanistic terms. For me, the smart community is the deliberate community, the community that really understands the dynamics that affect really how optimized they are as a place, and always how well people are thriving within it. So, you know, that awareness function is so important, I think, when you're working with communities. We tend to jump right into doing stuff and doing ideas and projects without first going back and talking about why this stuff matters and putting some real deliberation in the people's minds about why we should be doing this work. And so, you know, smart communities can mean a lot of different things, but I try to push for the interpretation that you don't hear as much, which is how can communities be very forward-facing and understanding the power of their community in a very smart way as far as design, but also how it can be the place for humans to thrive, which is a real basic tenet that we have as humans, is really to be in conjunction with our environment and not have being in a place that doesn't meet our particular human needs. So I think smart communities really take a holistic approach, and one of them has to be the human side of place.
Yeah, I agree. And I really like the word thrive. And it was something that I really looked at when I was traveling around. You know, we might have these, you know, great fancy projects happening here and there, but what's the percentage of people living below the poverty line in these cities and in these places? And what of those projects are actually helping them? And it's not as clear cut as, I guess, as people think it is. And it's a complex issue, but it doesn't mean it's not just as important to kind of think about and do.
Gotta keep doing it anyway. And I think that, you know, those communities where you're looking at, because when I talk to communities, I talk about on a scale of surviving to thriving. And so how are places and people doing? And are there a tale of two cities, if you will, where if you're in this certain category demographically, you're experiencing this city in a lot different way than somebody who's at this category. And so I think it's really important to be very thoughtful about that, because one of the things we've learned through my research is that whether you're at the highest end or at the most disadvantaged end, we all require the same things from our place. And those things don't change based on how big our pocketbooks are. And so we can't leave anyone behind when we're designing places, and understanding that disadvantaged communities are going to require something maybe a bit different, but at the heart of it, it's the same essence that we're pushing for when you're looking at maybe a community with much more advantage and opportunity.
Mm-hmm. Well, it kind of leads into this next question, which is, why do you think that this concept, the smart community concept, is so important?
I think because it puts city as not the backdrop in understanding our lives. I think we don't really realize that everything about our lives, from the moment we wake up till the time we go to sleep to how well we sleep overnight, is affected by where we live. I mean, it is a fundamental concept to the human existence. And so when you think about a smart city, what it says to me is that it's talking about, this is an entity that has a power, really, in affecting the outcomes we will achieve as humans. Will we achieve our best life, or we will achieve I made it through white-knuckled kind of life? Or how does that work? And that doesn't mean that everybody in every community can live wealthy or at the highest of the high, but can they live in a way that they feel dignity in the lives around them, that they're proud of their environment, that they feel like they attach or they belong around them? And do they feel like they are welcomed in that space, be exactly who they are? And so really with the smart city concept, I believe that it helps us put it more in the foreground than in the background, these issues that are really of critical importance to local economies and people themselves.
Okay.
Well, let's go to the US. And how do you think the US is currently embracing this concept?
You know, it's been a funny thing for me to witness. I think I've been doing this hard since Soul of the Community came out 2010. So we're almost at our 10-year anniversary of the last data collection. You know, Soul really changed the conversation around place in the U.S. And it was interesting. I think a lot of people saw some changes in how we perceive place. And it really came from one data finding, which was, now, for the first time in our country, young people will choose place over job. And that one simple change in the way that people are looking for jobs, going to jobs, has changed the way communities had to imagine themselves. It was no longer good enough to say, we've got tons of jobs here, or even to say to local businesses or large companies, you know, you can come, we'll give you a great tax break. That's not enough anymore, because people are looking more for what they can get from their place and really using their place as something that they are searching for and wanting to find that sense of belonging. So that's really different than the way the U.S. has really thought about community planning and city development. But still, even in the new years when we just were going out with this work, I think a lot of people thought, okay, it's the shiny penny. It'll go away. Let's not panic. You know, we don't have to turn everything upside down. It'll go. And it held on and really dug in, not only to cities, but to residents who finally felt, I think for the first time, okay to feel a sense of yearning to feel connected to place. And I have to say, I do think, as horrific as 9/11 was for my country, it really gave us a moment of unfreezing in the way that we think about things and look out for others and having this sense of pride. And it started as nationalism, but I can say that these days, I mean, there is a multi-billion dollar industry in my country around having place-based, like, signs and t-shirts saying, I love where I live, and this is my state, you can wear it on your necklace, it's really boomed in recent years, and people really starting to embrace localism and pride in place as really a hallmark of not only a heartfelt belief that we didn't talk about, but really putting it right out there on your mantle, so to speak, and showing a pride of place in a more commercialized way to really reinforce that this movement is pretty much here to stay.
Okay, let's move on to what you're currently doing. So the reason we met was at the Asia Pacific Summit. And so I heard you speak there and I was really excited about what you were talking about, the city doctor, right? And so tell us about the things that you're currently working on and what you're currently doing.
So I think that a lot of my work at this point, doing this for over a decade now, I'm still sending the message a lot. A lot of places are still wanting me to come out and talk about the research, talk about the data, to really frame conversations before they launch into a smart city or a placemaking initiative, to really help focus everybody in being on the same page about why this work is so important and supporting those communities. So the city doctor will always be hitting the road talking about these things. But I also still do research and practice in actually helping cities start to track how attached residents are to their place. I am delighted to see that so many mayors in Canada and here in the States and even in far-flung communities like Newfoundland, which is a part of Canada, but their own little island, are starting to look at attachment-based metrics as part of their report card that they studied about themselves that they deliver to their communities every year. So as much as economic growth is charted, attachment is starting to be charted. And to me, that's huge because it's saying that it's a metric that matters. But a lot of times cities need support in figuring out how to best measure that without breaking the bank. And it's easily scalable and easily done. So I really look forward to doing that work still. And then I do a lot of work with corporations and businesses that are in the business of worrying about attracting and retaining talent. And so going into a corporate setting with this model is a slightly different way to think about place from a retention perspective, but it's a powerful one because it really sets corporations to think differently about how they recruit and retain and how they think about employee engagement, which is, you know, a person could absolutely love their job, but when they leave the office, quote unquote, at the end of the day, if they're going into a city and really hating it there and not finding a connection, they stand as good a chance of losing that employee as if they just hated their job. So it has really changed the corporate conversation a lot to understand that the lines between workplace and actual place are very blurred and they have to dig in around those issues. And then lastly, I started a production company in the summer called Amazing Place Productions, which actually just tells the stories of place on stage as well as through community engagement and community experience events, because I found that through my own experience, one of the most powerful ways to get people to immediately feel a sense of belonging and wanting to be a part of something is to know that city's story so they can feel something they can attach to. And it's not always pretty, but it tells them about who their place is in such an intimate way that I have never seen another placemaking idea do as much in 2 hours to change the way people feel about their place than going through a live theatrical performance that really tells that story. So, and I love doing that work because it allows me to apply some of these principles in a really innovative way. So those are the things I'm working on.
Yeah, wow. That's really interesting. And I love that you're doing so many things, but they actually all come together. You know, the heart is still, you know, the same. I love that.
That's right. And I think it's part of my goal to show the systemic power of this basic model, you know, that you can go into a lot of different environments and have this work be applicable. And that really shows something pretty powerful about the model itself.
Yeah, no, that's awesome. I do a lot of work in and hope to do more in regional Australia. So I live in a small, not that small, but a regional town outside the city. And one of the biggest things is, I guess it is the attachment to place and people want to live there, but how they can also have the interesting jobs and that type of thing. And I think that's where this kind of digital thing that we can kind of work from anywhere, but it's just as much digital. If we don't have the foundational layer there, then it's not going to work very well. But the cultural attachment or the cultural change is really important as well. So I'm keen to hear your thoughts on how that kind of digital layer has changed our perception of place or whether it has.
Well, you know, it's interesting. When I was funded by Knight to do the Knight Soul of the Community project, which was a very expensive research project, a couple of $1 million, Knight Foundation was founded by journalists, two brothers who owned newspapers in a lot of cities in the U.S. And so one of the things that the president said to me at the time is like, I need to know, like I'm investing serious money in these communities and I need to know if there is a thing as place anymore. I mean, or can we just self-select into virtual places and so the actual geography of where we live isn't like it was in the 1950s and we've sort of one place is as good as another and there's not any kind of uniqueness to the power of the actual geography. Has technology kind of removed the need for us to know our neighbors or have a sense of connection because we can always connect digitally to have that connection? And so that was one of the main reasons why we even took this project on. And for the answer to come back so strongly that people still identify and attach to a geography now, that technology and the way that we run our lives, even though technology plays a completely different role than it used to, it hasn't replaced the need for people to still be human and be able to interact with other humans in such a way that actually helps them grow and be better humans themselves. And so, you know, figuring out how smart technologies are not the enemy. They're not the enemy because I know a lot of people are worried and it can to some extent start to isolate us, but it hasn't removed our basic love and need for a geographic space that we can identify with that we call community. So how do you use technology to support that? How do you use technology to connect people and help them find each other, perhaps in a geographic space, are still really powerful tools. It's like anything else, you know, any of these concepts or ideas can be used for good or evil. If your purpose and your intent behind them is to eliminate the need or try to isolate people or make them feel like if you're not part of this group, you don't belong. I mean, that's true for everything. I always used to say social capital in gangs is just negative social capital. It's still the same concept. You're just using it for negative means. And so I think technology is the same way. And we have to have a responsibility to know that it matters, but to know that it can be powerful and connecting place.
And I actually think, and correct me if I'm wrong, I'm just going off, not off data, but off what I've kind of talked about with a lot of people, is it's even enhanced the place in the sense of, I can work from anywhere, but the place I want to live is one that I've got my local coffee shop and this and that and the other. Whereas we, in the past, we may have given up that for a good job, right?
That's exactly right.
Yeah.
And I think just really quickly to add on to that, I think that a lot of corporations I've worked with and folks that are in the business of talent, they couldn't overnight make their places the place that people wanted to live. And so they had to start offering that as an in-between option. You know, they said, well, you can connect from live where you want and we will connect you in. We just don't want to lose you as talent. And so I think that has been the kind of the way that corporations have had to work around this new reality, is to make sure that people can have that as an option and they can support them in that and not lose them as talent.
And I've been having a lot of conversations in the kind of startup space now. And the amount of times I hear people saying, oh, I'll work for less, but I want to work for this company because they said I can work flexibly. And it's kind of not a given, but it's kind of like an expectation now that that's the thing that draws people in, right? The flexibility. And they might still go into the office because they enjoy going into the office, but it's really that choice and flexibility there and having that option to, okay, well, today I'm going to work from home, tomorrow I'll work from the cafe, oh, but I'm going to go in for this meeting to see someone face to face on Wednesday, but I can avoid peak hour traffic because it's at 11 o'clock or whatever circumstances are. So I've really seen that shift in, oh, well, I'm going here because it gives me the most money and, you know, status or something like that. So it's been interesting.
It's been a very interesting way to see humans sort of embrace this whole switch from work to live to work. You know, that we're no longer these live to work humans. And I think in my country, it happened when the economy fell out around 2010, where people were like, wait a minute. And this happened in older generations as well that were still in the workforce. We're saying, wait a minute, I'm giving you my blood, sweat, and tears. And at the end of the day, I could just be fired and I would have nothing because I haven't built a life outside of work, because I thought work would always be here for me, like I'm always here for it. And once people decided they weren't going to take that compromise anymore and they were going to be more judicious in their work-life balance, it really did start to change that conversation, even in older groups, not just young talent, where there's a different approach to thinking about work these days.
I agree, because a lot of people talk about millennials and younger people or whatever doing all these things. But I'm like, the biggest group of entrepreneurs that I know are women like in their 50s, you know? Because it makes sense, right? Yeah, I agree. I don't think it's exclusive to young people. It's just that it's in the media or whatever is millennials. And
that's the way it comes off. Yeah, I agree.
Okay, let's go on to this next question, which is about integration. So how do you think that we can better integrate across the different disciplines, government, academia, industries, and community?
Well, I think one of the most powerful things in doing that work, and this is really where I have to put my shrink hat on more than I normally would, is an understanding that you cannot guilt people into saying this is the right thing to do. You know, you can't guilt a local government into joining a place-based movement by saying, you know, this community is being left behind and this community is being left behind. What you can do that I think is powerful is that you show them why it's in their best interest to behave this way or why it's in their best interest. You have to kind of put yourselves in their minds and what are the things they're struggling with and what are the problems that they can't seem to answer and what's going on in their world so that we're not pushing our world into theirs. We're having to kind of walk in their world for a minute and see what drives their motivation. What are the things that they care about that's going to affect the way they behave? And so I think, you know, with some of the community, I have to say, when we did the research, it was really important for me to understand what are the things about a place that makes people fall in love with it. But if I had just stayed with that dynamic, it would not have been the worldwide phenomenon that it was. What made it huge is that we tacked on the so what. So what if people feel attached to where they live? And we looked at a lot of things like I talked about at the conference, but the one that got a lot of people's attention was the local economic growth metric because we were struggling so much. And so figuring out the so what that matters to that sector and understanding from an empirical perspective how you can create a place argument that gets to their so what that matters. That's how you get people in the room that would not be in the room before. Because if you do a need-based argument to folks, needs are everywhere. There's a lot of competing demands on our economies and on our dollars. So we can't just say, well, this is the right thing to do. You need to do this from a social perspective, a humanistic, social justice, however you want to. It doesn't work. What works is the so what. And the so what these days in place is so powerful that it does get people's attentions across sectors. So even if they come at it with their own little agenda, it doesn't matter because the core principles that you're working on are the same. It's just that everybody has their own piece of the pie to be part of the solution. But they won't start to be part of the solution until you create for them a so what that puts central in the agenda moving forward.
Mm-hmm. So what are the emerging trends that people aren't talking about enough?
That's really interesting. The emerging trends that people aren't talking about enough is, in my world, because I also have a faculty appointment at the local university here, is that we have a tendency in this field, like many fields, we're not alone, to kind of talk in an echo chamber, and we don't bring it to the people as much as we should. I think that like any discussion, when it stays primarily academic, then it never really gets to the point that it serves the people we're supposed to be serving. So I think we need to talk about the fact that we sometimes are so excited by our own ideas that we're not implementing them as quickly as we should. The other thing I think we're not talking about as much as we should is our failures. I think that we are so excited and motivated to show a track record of progress around place-based initiatives that we hide when something didn't work the way we thought it would and implementation didn't go the way we wanted it to. It's like when you're designing something new all the time, there are going to be things that don't work. But if you don't share what didn't work or why you think it didn't work, then the next person, the next place is going to fall in that same hole because nobody wanted to talk about what didn't go well. And I think that's a real, you know, problem we have is we want to be so cheerleady that we're not scientific all the time and being real transparent about when things don't work. And I think the other thing I would say is I know in my country, there's a lot of conversations around race relations and how do you bring disparate groups together and how do you do this work? And I think our knee-jerk reaction has always been, well, let's do a race relations initiative or let's do a community conversation about immigrants or let's do this, that, or the other thing. And I can tell you from funding those kinds of initiatives, they can be kind of damaging actually to communities, because what you do is you pull people in a room to talk about difference, and then the whole 4 hours, what you end up doing is exploiting and identifying exactly the difference that keeps them apart and trying to get the other side to change. But instead, talking about differences in community from a place of common ground. So I've actually done race relations initiatives where the entire focus of the work is, how can I empirically figure out what all these people have in common? What are the priorities that they all care about? What are the values that they all care about? And set them to work on making those values or those priorities stronger in the community. And that's how you bring people together. You find their common ground. You don't punish people for not thinking, quote, the right way about an issue. And so I think that's more of not that we're not talking about it, but we're talking about it in the wrong way, when there's actually a much more powerful way to get people to really mobilize around an issue. And by doing so, create organic bonds between each other that might not have existed and certainly wouldn't exist after a 6-hour race relations dialogue in the community.
It's just been a really great chat with you. So thanks so much for coming on the podcast. I guess we should wrap it up there. But yeah, it's been really awesome to chat with you. And I really look forward to having another conversation at some point.
That'd be great.
Thank you. It's been so great to chat with you. And let's just finish off with the last question, which is, how can people connect with you?
Well, I think the best way to connect with me is through Facebook. The City Doctor or Dr. Catherine Laughlin will take you to my professional Facebook page. You might also find my personal page, but unless you want to just see posts about my kid, you really won't enjoy it. So look for Dr. Catherine Laughlin or the City Doctor on Facebook. I also have a website, citydoctor.com. So it's city-doctor.com. There's a link that can connect you directly to me through the page. And just be looking for me. I mean, I'm there on Twitter. I'm on Instagram. I'm everywhere. And I really do love hearing from folks. So please feel free to reach out in any of those formats and I'll get back to you and we can talk.
Awesome. Well, we'll put the links in the show notes so people can click away and find you.
Perfect.
Talk soon. Bye.
Bye.
Bye. Thanks so much for listening to the Smart Community Podcast. Show notes for this episode and all other episodes are available on our website, mysmart.community. If you have any questions for us or any of our guests, you can email hello@mysmart.community or find us on the socials. We are on LinkedIn, Facebook, and Twitter @smartcompod. That's com with 2 M's. If you are enjoying the podcast, please leave us a rating and review at wherever you listen. This really helps us reach more ears, so thank you in advance. As always, I hope you enjoyed listening to this episode as much as I enjoyed making it.
The Smart Community Podcast is what you're looking for.